Welcome to Learning English from the Voice of America. I'm Katie Weaver. Today, we hear reports from Mario Ritter, Brian Lynn, and Anna Mateo. And we close the show with our American History program, The Making of a Nation. Here's Mario Ritter.
There is increasing debate over migration in Britain as more asylum seekers arrive on the country's southern coast in small boats. A small number of migrants usually attempts the crossing from France each year. However, the government says that more than 400 people have tried to cross the 30-kilometer-wide English Channel in the last 4 months. The government has called it a major problem and has redeployed patrol ships to the Channel from a joint European Union activity in the Mediterranean Sea. During a visit to the port of Dover recently, Home Secretary Sajid Javid questioned why asylum seekers were coming to Britain.
If you are a genuine asylum seeker, then why have you not sought asylum in the first safe country that you arrived in? Because, you know, France is not a country where anyone would argue is not safe.
Most of the recent asylum seekers appear to have come from Iran. They are trying to cross in air-filled boats in the middle of winter. The trip is dangerous because the English Channel is one of the world's busiest shipping paths and because of strong tides and currents. Critics say the number of asylum seekers is still low. They accuse the government of falsely claiming there is a crisis. The government denies this. Most asylum seekers arrive on airplanes. Many others hide under or inside trucks heading to Britain. Experts suggest increased security in French ports could be driving migrants to attempt the crossing by sea. Nurul Hadi Oryakhail is from Afghanistan. He fled the Taliban in his country. He came to Britain hidden inside a refrigerated truck 3 years ago when he was 16 years old. That was too cold, he told VOA. Oryakhail gained asylum in Britain. He was helped by the aid organization Kent Refugee Action Network. The group says it helps unaccompanied migrant children with housing, education, and basic needs. Bridget Chapman is with the group. She discussed the seriousness of the problem.
It's a crisis in that people are being forced to put their lives at risk to make a claim for asylum. That's completely unacceptable.
But she said that the number of people crossing the channel was relatively small. She blamed politicians for making migration a political issue. The government denies such accusations. It says deploying naval ships will help prevent smugglers and migrants from making the dangerous crossing. Still others say that naval ships will only lead more migrants to make the sea crossing in hopes they will be rescued. I'm Mario Ritter, Jr.
Many of us think about our dream home. When designer Chris Toledo dreams about his, he lets his imagination run wild. He wants a Spanish-style house with hand-painted floor tiles, circling staircases, and at least 12 bedrooms. That is his dream. For now, Toledo lives in a small two-bedroom apartment. But that has not stopped him from building his dream home. It is just a lot smaller. A lot. Toledo was born and raised in Southern California. He has been working on his miniature Spanish-style dream home for the past 2 years.
Here in California, Spanish style is very common. You know, you can't go anywhere in Los Angeles without seeing Spanish-style houses.
The beauty of these mansions is there for anyone to see on the outside. But it is not easy to get a look at the inside of these homes. Homeowners protect their mansions with security gates, walls, and in some cases, armed guards. But Toledo found a way to get around all that security. He went online and looked at houses for sale on real estate websites.
I would go on real estate websites and look at houses that are for sale that are the same style, the same age period, and I would just look and see all the original details. And most of the houses that I used for inspiration, they were probably about $2 to $10 million.
Inspired by the Mediterranean style, he researched the style thoroughly. He filled his Spanish-style mini mansion with objects true to that style. Many he made by hand. His miniature version is as real as he can make it. His small house is made of real wood. He covered the wood with a material that would have been part of a real Spanish-style building. He hand-painted over 6,000 small tiles for the floors. The house even has electricity, and Toledo made all the lights by hand. He also made other household objects, like tables and pillows. Other objects he bought and then painted to fit the house. He even included a copy of a very old oil painting that he found in a book on Spanish design. Toledo's final creation is extremely true to life. The bathroom sinks have water markings. The lighting fixtures have extremely small spider webs. Other pieces have dust on them. The only thing his miniature mansion does not have is running water. Toledo was afraid it would ruin the building. One person has already offered Toledo $80,000 for his miniature dream home. Toledo says he plans to use that money for a down payment on a home. I'm Ana Mateo.
The best paying jobs in the United States often require successful completion of a study program at a college or university. But a new study suggests there are also millions of good jobs for people with only a high school education. The study was a project of the Center on Education and the Workforce at Georgetown University in Washington, D.C. Its findings were based on U.S. government information. Financial company J.P. Morgan Chase provided money for the research. The Georgetown researchers defined a good job as one paying at least $35,000 a year for U.S. workers between the ages of 25 and 44 years. For those between 45 and 64, a good job was said to pay at least $45,000 a year. The study identified three general paths leading to a good job: a high school education, middle skills, and bachelor's degree, or BA, from a college or university. The high school path is meant for workers with a high school education or less. The middle skills group included workers with more than a high school diploma but less than a bachelor's degree. Included in this group were people who earned an associate degree or attended classes or training in college but did not have such a degree. The report noted that after World War II, U.S. workers with a high school diploma or less were able to get good-paying middle-class jobs. It said that is because there were a large number of jobs in manufacturing and other industries requiring physical labor. Most of these jobs were filled by workers with only a high school education. But over the years, manufacturing kept moving toward greater use of machines. In addition, the U.S. and world economies went through major changes. These developments created a need for a more educated and skilled workforce. The report said that in the manufacturing-based economy of the past, about two-thirds of entry-level jobs required a high school diploma or less. Today, two-thirds of jobs require at least some education or training in addition to high school, it found. The researchers estimated that in 1991, 15 million good jobs existed for those with a high school diploma. About 12 million good middle skills jobs were available, while 18 million existed for people with a bachelor's degree. By 2016, the report found the high school path led to only 13 million good jobs. However, those 13 million jobs were responsible for about 20% of all good jobs, the study found. The middle skills group grew to 16 million, while the path for bachelor's degree holders doubled to 36 million good jobs. Anthony Carnevale is director of the Center on Education and the Workforce and a lead researcher on the project. While it's no surprise that the BA economy has doubled the number of good jobs it provides, it really struck us that the high school economy still provides 13 million good jobs, he said. We also found it surprising that even though blue-collar jobs declined, middle skills jobs have grown considerably. The report said that the long-term future for high school-educated workers is unclear. But it estimated about 27% of U.S. workers aged 25 to 34 with a high school diploma currently have a good job. The financial website Kiplinger.com recently examined a collection of data to identify the highest-paying jobs for Americans without a college degree. Among the top-rated were sales representative, computer user support specialist, and powerline installer, Kiplinger reported. As the population ages, America's healthcare industry will provide many more jobs for people without a college degree. These are expected to include health technologist, medical secretary, medical assistant, and dental assistant, Kiplinger noted. Other top jobs identified for high school diploma holders included oil, gas, and mine service operator, self-improvement education teacher, flight attendant, and plumber. I'm Brian Lynn.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to the Making of a Nation. I'm Steve Ember. In 1850, the northern and southern states threatened to split over the issue of slavery. At that time, owning slaves was legal in the southern states. Many northerners opposed slavery, and the question remained, should slavery be legal in new territories in the western part of the country? The two sides disagreed strongly, but the issue needed to be settled. So Senator Henry Clay of Kentucky offered a compromise. Conservative Southern lawmakers rejected it. John C. Calhoun of South Carolina especially spoke against the compromise, but other lawmakers supported it, including one of the nation's top political leaders. Senator Daniel Webster of Massachusetts said the compromise was the only way to save the Union of States. 4 days after Webster's speech, Senator William Seward of New York presented his ideas to the Senate and to the nation. Seward was a Northerner. He said he opposed any compromise with the South. He said he did not want slavery in the new Western territories, and he called for a national policy to start peacefully ending slavery everywhere. Seward criticized Daniel Webster for speaking against abolition societies. He said such groups represented a moral movement that could not be stopped. He said the movement would continue until all the slaves in America were free. Seward then criticized John C. Calhoun. He denounced Calhoun's demands for a political balance between the North and South. He said this forced balance would change the United States from a united national democracy to an alliance of independent states. In such a system, he said, the minority would be able to veto actions of the majority. A few weeks after Seward spoke, John C. Calhoun died. One newspaper in Calhoun's home state said, "The senator's death is best for the country and his own honor. The slavery question will now be settled." Calhoun would have blocked a settlement. In fact, many lawmakers had come to support the idea of Senator Henry Clay's compromise, but they could not agree on which parts of it to pass first. Southern supporters were afraid that if a statehood bill for California was passed first, then Northerners would refuse to pass the other parts of the compromise. So Southerners wanted to include all parts in one bill. A committee of 13 men was named to write a bill based on Henry Clay's compromise. The committee had 6 members from slave states and 6 from free states. Senator Clay was named to lead it. 3 weeks later, the committee offered its bill. It was much like the compromise Clay had first proposed. It made California a free state. It created territorial governments for New Mexico and Utah. It settled the border dispute between Texas and New Mexico. It ended the slave trade in the nation's capital, the District of Columbia, and it urged approval of a new law dealing with runaway slaves. For about a month, the bill seemed to have the support of President Zachary Taylor. But then the president made it clear that he would do everything he could to defeat it. Taylor did not think the nation was in crisis. He did not believe the dispute over slavery was as serious as others did. He had his own plan to settle one part of the dispute. He would make the new territory of California a free state. There, slavery would be banned. Taylor's plan did not, however, settle other parts of the dispute. It said nothing about laws on escaped slaves. It said nothing about slavery in the District of Columbia. It also said nothing about the border dispute between Texas and New Mexico. Senator Clay, who had offered the compromise, questioned President Taylor's limited proposal. Clay said, "Now, what is the plan of the president? Here are five problems, five wounds that are bleeding and threatening the life of the republic. What is the president's plan? Is it to heal all these wounds? No such thing. It is to heal one of the five and to leave the other four to bleed more than ever." While the debate continued in Washington, the situation in Texas and New Mexico got worse. Texas claimed a large part of New Mexico, including the capital, Santa Fe. Early in 1850, Texas sent a representative to Santa Fe to take control of the government. The United States military commander in New Mexico advised the people not to recognize the man. The governor of Texas was furious. He decided to send state soldiers to enforce Texas's claims in New Mexico. He said if trouble broke out, the United States government would be to blame. President Taylor rejected Texas's claims. He told his Secretary of War to send an order to the military commander in New Mexico. The commander was to use force to oppose any attempt by Texas to seize the territory. The Secretary of War said he would not send such an order. He believed that if fighting began, Southerners would hurry to the aid of Texas. And that, he thought, might be the start of a Southern struggle against the federal government. In a short time, the North and South would be at war. So the Secretary of War refused to sign the order. President Taylor answered sharply, "Then I will sign the order myself." Taylor had been a general before becoming president. He said he would take command of the army himself to enforce the law. And he said he was willing to hang anyone who rebelled against the Union. President Taylor began writing a message to Congress on the situation. He never finished it. On July 4, 1850, Taylor attended an outdoor Independence Day ceremony. The event was held on the grounds where a monument to America's first president, George Washington, was being built. The day was very hot, and Taylor stood for a long time in the burning sun. That night, he became sick with pains in his stomach. Doctors were called to the White House, but none of their treatments worked. 5 days later, President Zachary Taylor died. His vice president, Millard Fillmore, was sworn in as president. Millard Fillmore was from New York State. His family was poor. His early education came not from school teachers, but from whatever books he could find. Later, Fillmore was able to study law. He became a successful lawyer. He also served in the United States Congress for 8 years. The Whig Party chose him as its candidate for vice president in the election of 1848. He served in the office for about a year and a half before the death of President Taylor. Fillmore had disagreed with Taylor over the Congressional Compromise on Slavery and the Western Territories. Unlike Taylor, Fillmore truly believed that the nation was facing a crisis, and he truly believed the compromise would help save the Union. Now, as president, Fillmore offered his complete support to the compromise bill. Its chances of passing looked better than ever. Fillmore asked the old cabinet to resign. He named his own cabinet members. All were strong supporters of the Union. All supported the compromise. Congress debated the compromise bill throughout the summer of 1850. The bill included several proposals. Supporters decided not to vote on the proposals as one piece of legislation. They saw a better chance of success by trying to pass each proposal separately. Their idea worked. By the end of September, both the Senate and House of Representatives had approved all parts of the 1850 Compromise. President Fillmore signed them into law. One part of the compromise permitted California to enter the Union as a free state. One established territorial governments in New Mexico and Utah. One settled the dispute between Texas and New Mexico. Another ended the slave trade in the District of Columbia. Many happy celebrations took place when Americans heard that President Fillmore had signed the 1850 Compromise. Many people believed the problem of slavery had been solved. They believed the Union had been saved. Others, however, believed the problem only had been postponed. They hoped the delay would give reasonable people of the North and South time to find a permanent answer to the issue of slavery. Time was running out. It was true that the 1850 Compromise had ended a national crisis, but both Northern and Southern extremists remained bitter. Those opposed to slavery believed the compromise law on runaway slaves violated the Constitution. The issue of slavery was linked to the issue of secession. Did states have the right to leave the Union? If Southern states rejected all compromises on slavery, did they have the right to secede? The signing of the 1850 Compromise cooled the debate for a time, but disagreement on the issues was deep. It would continue to build over the next 10 years.
And that's our show for today. For VOA Learning English, I'm Katie Weaver.